Blog Talk Radio.
This is Robert Greenall. This is Robert Greenall. General Quarters. General Quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thanks a lot for taking your time today to come join us for another edition of Midrats. And we have something a little unusual today. We have two guests. Two 30-minute blocks, and our guest for the first half of the hour is a returning guest who we're really glad to have back. It's going to be Stephen Phillips. Steve is a 1992 graduate of the United States Naval Academy. He began his career as a surface warfare officer aboard the USS Harlan County and the USS San Jacinto. He then applied and was accepted to the Navy Special Operations Community, and he subsequently served as an Exploded Ordnance Disposal Technician at EOD Mobile Unit 6, 8, and 10. He is also an author. We had him on previously to discuss his award-winning debut novel, Proximity. It talks about the life of a Navy EOD technician and our war on terrorism. And we have him on here today to discuss his second novel, The Recipient's Son, which is a coming-of-age story that takes place at U.S. Naval Academy in the late 80s and early 90s. Then at the bottom of the half of the hour, we're going to, unfortunately, I don't have the Emperor's March from Star Wars available, but we're going to have as our guest somebody who doesn't quite have that black of a cloak. I kid him. It's a really good guy coming on to talk about a tough job. We're going to have as our guest for the second half of the hour, Lieutenant Commander Chris Cervello, United States Navy. He is director at the Navy Desk and public affairs assistant to the Vice Chief of Naval Operations. But, hey, let's get on with our first guest, Steve. Welcome back to Midrats.
Hi, Sal and Eagle One. Thanks for having me back again. I'm looking forward to talking to you both about my second novel.
Well, Steve, it's really good to have you on here. We liked, we're both Eagle One and myself are kind of book geeks, so it's always good to have authors on, especially authors that are hitting on topics that the national security area, especially the maritime corner of it, is really going to find of interest. And I want to let those who may have read the book or those that are looking to buy the book, if you have some questions or observations after you've read or just something you'd like for us to roll in our guest, I forgot to mention early on, go to the bottom of the show page if you're with us live, and you can join the chat room there, and Eagle One and I will be monitoring it. And you can go ahead and hop in there. If you have some questions, observations, we'll pull them out and fold them in as we go forward. But one thing I'd like to start off, Steve, is just for those that haven't read your second novel, The Recipient's Son, yet, if you could just outline the plot of it. We know it takes place in the Naval Academy in the 80s or the 90s, but what type of storyline are we looking at?
Yeah, you described it well by saying it's a coming-of-age story, which is very different from my first novel. Proximity is clearly an action novel. It's a, you know, the good guys going and kicking down doors and blowing stuff up. So this is a story about a young man at the Naval Academy in the early 90s, and he's a fictional classmate of my own, a member of the class of 1992, who has the unique and rare distinction of being the son of a posthumously awarded Medal of Honor recipient from the Vietnam War. And the notion is that if you're a son or daughter of a Medal of Honor recipient, you have automatic acceptance into any of the service academies. That's one of the benefits that is extended to those children. Not everybody is necessarily aware of that. And so his name is Donald Dorego, and Donald goes to the Naval Academy and sort of for the first time in his life has a shared experience with his father, albeit 20-some years later. And it is through his experience at the Naval Academy that he learns to identify with who his father was and his father's naval service. And so It's as if he's finally able to connect to that identity through that shared experience. So what drives the plot is it starts on service selection night, which at that time, service selection is done differently now. When I was there, it was straight, basically service selection based on class rank. And you were literally called down on the 1MC. They'd get on and say, number 1 through 110, come on down. So it starts on service selection night, and then shortly after that, he's accused of harassment. So again, this is spring of his first class year. And he's kind of struggling with, oh my goodness, I could possibly get kicked out for this accusation. So then we get a flashback to his plebe year, and we see then I think really the bulk of the novel is that, is him going through that identification with his father and learning to struggle through who his own identity is in the life. And then, of course, at the end, I bring you back to the modern day, and the story comes to its conclusion, which I won't give too much away. But as I laid all that out, what I also tried to do was very purposefully do a couple of things when I wrote the book. First, I wanted to describe the Naval Academy during my era because I think it was a unique time. You know, we came in 1988. It was a 600-plus ship Navy. It was the Cold War. And we always thought that if we ever were in combat, we'd be fighting the Russians. By the time we graduated, the Navy was downsizing. The Berlin Wall had fallen, and we had been to war during Desert Storm. And so I wanted to just sort of describe that through this storyline. Second, I wanted to present the different leadership styles through a variety of scenarios so that students and practitioners of naval leadership might sit back and discuss it. So there's very purposefully laid out different second-class, I'd say, that the guy has to reflect on. So the different styles of his different upper class. Third, I wanted to make sure I shared some aspects of naval history and Naval Academy history. So, again, I described the USS Summers affair, which was when Midshipman Philip Spencer mutinied on board a ship that ended up leading to midshipmen being trained for. And then, or Colonel Ripley is another example. I discussed Colonel Ripley at the bridge. He was the Marine Corps captain at the time who blew up the Dong Ha Bridge and as a result prevented the North Vietnamese from invading South Vietnam in 1972. So I know that's a mouthful, but there's a lot of things that I purposely laced through this and put on the backs of this character, Donald Dorego, to relay to the audience so that they could, in both an entertaining and informative way, learn about the U.S. Naval Academy.
Well, it's a good book. Oddly enough, as I was reading the section on service selection, my younger son called me from his ROTC unit and had just been advised that he'd been selected for the program he's always wanted to go into. So the timing was impeccable as far as being able to read the book and understand what was going on in that. And let me note that I don't think I've really understood much about Naval Academy alumni, not being one myself, that I served with until I went through some of the aspects of your book. I'm obviously a little older than you are, but there are the aspects of the traditions at the Academy that have continued from generation to generation. A lot of the things, like the message to Garcia and all that kind of stuff, don't make much sense to people who come from ROTC units, but I can understand in the context of the Academy. And your book helped me do that much more about the Academy. How much of that was the intent of what you were writing to kind of go ahead.
Sure. Absolutely was part of the intent of what I wanted to do. Message to Garcia is a really good example. That is something that has been enduring, that has been at the Academy, longstanding. And I did want to relay traditions and show both aspects. Clearly, there are parts of naval tradition and the U.S. Navy and the Naval Academy that change over time. You know, if any graduate now who goes and returns can go and see that there are differences. But there are also clearly things that remain the same, and that is how the place gets part of its identity. And I definitely ensure that I put those aspects in as part of the foundation because I knew that part of my audience would be Naval Academy alum who would enjoy the book and be tickled by reading things that they could recognize, even though the book is not set during their era or their time that they were there. But I also then wanted it to be read by young people who might be interested in going to the Academy to get a flavor of what it's like or what they will find if they go there. So yeah, that was definitely also another very purposeful aspect of it. So I appreciate that you were able to pick up on it.
I thought another thing that I really enjoyed about the book is, and you brought up one of the things you use your characters as a way to describe different leadership styles, good leadership, bad leadership, a topic that we discussed last week with Claude Berube as well. And I think especially for that audience, it's a great venue to do that. And I'm sure you drew on people you've known, you built some composite characters. I thought you did a real good job with Commander Gordon. I won't give away too much, but you described him such that I physically could see the guy, and I know the type of leader you're exactly talking about there, because they are there. And one thing I wanted to ask is, you go through, and especially something that is as close and personal as being a Naval Academy alumni that you are — I'm not, I'm a ROTC guy — to be able to draw into that and to build your characters without, you know, creating a blueprint of somebody. As you built your characters and some of your classmates and others who went to the Academy have read it, have you had any of them come back at you and go, hey, is that supposed to be, you know, person so-and-so? Or
right.
Have tried to say, I wish you had added this extra because it reminds me of somebody else?
Right. I have had those conversations, and I was very forthright in ensuring that no single character could be connected to a person in real life. Clearly, there are some historical characters that are accurate. Heinz Lenz, for example, who used to lead the brigade in physical training, is mentioned in the book. Unfortunately, he has passed away. So that's a real person identified by his actual name. All of the characters that are fictional, like the various midshipmen, the company officers, even the superintendent and the commandant and the deputy dot, they are fictionalized characters. And I was very careful to make sure that there were aspects of them that were fictionalized such that they could not be connected, although I will readily admit that there were elements that I wanted to use. And so some of the characters on first glance might appear that they're actual. And I'll give a specific example. The company commander in 14th Company is Captain Oberle, Marine Corps Infantry Company officer. It just so happens my company officer was a Marine Infantry officer. But I wanted to make sure that Oberle, other than that, was not the same character, is not the same person, and it is not. And the reason was I wanted to reflect the notion that it is a common phenomena when you have a company officer of a particular field, and especially Marine Corps Infantry, they often have a positive influence on the midshipmen that are in their company, and then therefore will end up drawing many midshipmen to their career field. That ended up happening to me in my class. We had an inordinate number of Marines because of the positive leadership of my actual company officer. So save for that thread, I made sure that I put characteristics of him so it could not be confused with the real man. I then went to my company mates and had a couple of them act as editors for me and read, and purposefully with that eye to make sure that it didn't cross that boundary.
When you're writing a book, you went through the various communities in the Navy and the Marine Corps, and you picked up on some of the worst aspects of, I think, of every community except the aviation group. But how tempting is it to, or is it something you had to rein back in to go off on I was eating their young, or the characteristics of submarine community? Is that a stop doing when you're writing a book like this?
Yeah, it is something that I want to do when I write, because I am sometimes frustrated by Hollywood perception created of anything, that everything is perfect and shiny and new and everything. I always want to depict any given community realistically, and therefore if you do that, often that means showing its flaws. Let me reflect back to proximity. many people writing a book about the Navy EOD community, all the guys would be big, tall, handsome, you know, and, you know, their hair is always perfect and the like. Whereas I very purposefully talked about the guys being in the boat and being seasick, you know, and having to dive, and so showing their weakness and their flaws and that they're getting seasick, in part because I suffered seasickness when I was a Navy diver. So for me, I recognized that I was identifying the flaws of some of those community, the fact that the SWOs eat their young, the fact that the Submariner maybe is a guy who goes by a checklist and favors the guys that are in his community, because I want to reflect the truth. And if I was overzealous, then I would accept that as a criticism. But that's the perspective that I'm coming from, is I didn't want to write something that I think everybody knows from on the surface, excuse the pun, what a submarine officer's role is. So I wanted to definitely weave in the other aspects in Commander Gordon, or the notion from some of the surface warfare officers that are company officers that, you know, that they eat their young, that their career is challenging and the like.
I think you are well inside the lifelines there. My father had a great phrase like, stereotypes exist because more than often than not, they're accurate. There is a broad brush there, but everything does have its own flavor. We, you know, we all have our stories about going to dinner with the different personality types. But you mentioned early on how, you know, part of the reasons that you wrote The Recipient Son was to help give some people some a little more nuanced and background view of what things are like in the Naval Academy. Have you gotten some feedback, or have you heard from some young men and women who are in high school who are enlisted or looking at going to the Naval Academy that may have read the book and had some questions for you? Have you received feedback from people at that end of the pipe? And if so, what have most of their questions and interests been about?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's a short answer for that one. I have not heard from anyone in that realm yet, in part, I think, because the book is so new. It's just been about a month that it's been out. And so thus far, I think the folks who have found it, by and large, are guys who are graduates or have some connection to the Naval Academy. So thus far, most of my feedback are from my peers or my near peers. I'll tell you what, if ever I hear from youngsters that are reading it, that are interested in the community, I will give you guys some feedback on it. Maybe I can come back and we can talk about it at length.
Well, over in the chat room, I just saw Jerry Hendricks' 16-year-old daughter wants to read the book now, so maybe we'll have an early adopter that can give you that perspective feedback. Eagle One, didn't mean to step on you. Go ahead.
Oh, that's all right. When did you decide to write this book, and how long did it take you to put it together?
Yeah, that's a great question, and a classic one that an author gets about writing a book. I first started to write this book immediately when I was on Harlan County, shortly after I graduated from the Naval Academy and started my service as a junior officer. And it was one of these things that I spent a little bit of time on every now and again when I had a chance. Recently, a shipmate of mine, who was actually my state roommate on Harlan County for a while, said that to me. He said, "I remember when you started writing this thing." So I will bet that in the aggregate, maybe I had spent a year combined time up until about 2010 writing the first, say, 50,000 words of it. You know, first I sort of scoped out what the idea was, who the main character would be, what the themes I would want to come from the book, and then started writing it and wrote a good portion of it and laid out much of it. But then I felt like I wasn't ready for it to come out, and I was spurned on then by proximity. And when that book came to me, it came and I wrote that one again, probably about the same time period. It took about 2 years, but really plowed through it and got that one out. And so then I came back to this one, and I approached the Naval Institute Press first with proximity and to see if they had an interest in it. And they passed on that, but then I presented them the idea of The Recipient Son. They liked it, and so in 2010, I really then had to scrub it out, add to it, build it up, shore it up, and bring it to its full fruition. So they got it in, it was in December of 2011. So all in all, it probably took me about 2 years to compile the whole thing and then get it to the press. And then naturally, we went through the editing process. I did some both with my peers, and then obviously did some with the press themselves.
I've been on active duty just to, I joined active duty just a few years before you did. So, you know, one thing that as a pup I saw take place was the whole post-tailhook fiasco and some of the political influence and a lot of things that we saw. And part of the book that you touch on is something that I didn't really appreciate until I'd been on active duty for a while, and I was talking to, you know, some of my shipmates who graduated from the academy. And my guess has always been it's just because Annapolis is so bloody close to D.C. But there is, for those that aren't aware of it or when they first come aware of it, a surprising amount of political influence and or interference, depending on how you would look at it, for the goings-on at the Naval Academy. Has that – it's always been there, of course, and it's in the other service academies as well. But has that gotten worse, gotten better, or perhaps changed flavors over the years, if you want to use as a reference mark how you describe it in your book?
Sure. So first I'll say that it is true. The Naval Academy, I think, is always under the political spotlight because of its closeness to Washington, D.C. And that my idea has been, and I'm sure many other midshipmen, former mids would say this, it's because a senator or congressman can very quickly get in a car and be down here and see and look at what's going on. I think in some ways the academy is also, of the service academies, the one that is most physically visible, right? It's right downtown Annapolis. People can relatively easily, you know, walk onto the campus. In comparison to West Point, I think is a little bit further away. You know, Air Force Academy, it's like 10 miles from the gate to where the main part of the campus is. So I think all of those things come together to make it a place that is much easier to be under the political spotlight. I think that it is true from my time all the way to now. And I live in the D.C. area. I've sponsored midshipmen. I hear the feedback from the brigade on these things. As it always is with those things, some of it is positive and some of it is negative. I was a midshipman during the tailhook times, and you know, naturally it was something that we all talked about, and it was things that were brought up and challenged to us. And one of the themes, and I would say this is maybe even a third level theme in the book. It's not something that I wanted to use it as part of historical background, but my intention was not to like, you know, grind any axes about tailhook or about political correctness or that. But I wanted to reflect that it in fact happened. And the main character himself reflects on and says, some of these changes that came about were positive, but as occurs in any of those political changes, sometimes the pendulum has swung too far and there's some aspects of it that have gone too far. So I think that has been true. It was true in my day. I think it's still true today.
As you, this is a book about personal growth and about leadership, but the subtitle has to do with it being a tale of honor. You want to discuss the honor aspect of the book without giving the book away?
Sure. So there's, again, multiple layers. The first level of honor is sort of the main character is accused of harassment, and he is frustrated by that, as are the people around him. His mentor, Master Chief Strong, his very close friend and the JAG officer, Lieutenant Jan Meyer, because first they don't think that he's actually guilty of it, and they think that it's sort of a kangaroo court is emerging in this accusation of him that is laced with politics, because the midshipman who he's accused of harassing, she is politically connected. And so there's sort of this notion of, so at what point do we respect and honor the honor code, the honor system? And he's not accused of an honor code, but there's this notion of, you know, what is the honorable thing to do? What's the honorable way to proceed? What is the honorable way to go about this? And that there's this notion of the system is being used against him and politics are being used against him and other midshipmen. He's not the only one that's accused. And so that is struggling with sort of his honor. This is the next layer down, that he feels towards the legacy of serving his father, to the point where he comes to a very interesting inner conflict of, he sort of, they say, so use your dad's honor as a trump card to get out of this. If you fight politics with politics, in effect, you should call attention to the fact that you're the son of a Medal of Honor recipient, and in effect, because of the politics of this place, your charges will be dropped, it'll be swept under the carpet and the like. And he struggles with that and sort of says, if that's the way I'm going to get through this, I'm not sure I want to belong to this system. I don't know that I want to serve in this Navy. Maybe I do want to be kicked out. So I can share that without completely ruining the story and say that it's part of the character's aspect of him struggling with his identity of his father and what it means and what he's going to use that identity for. So that, I think, is where the subtitle comes from.
We talked a little bit about before, you know, waiting to get the feedback from the youngsters, so to speak, who might be interested in the Naval Academy. But as somebody who obviously has written something very personal, you know, looking back at the time you were there, and of course there is that very personal attachment to the Naval Academy. But there are also some other authors out there that have written about the Naval Academy, either their experiences or it in general. Are there some other books out there that young men and women who might be thinking about going to the Naval Academy or the service academies that you would recommend to them in hindsight that they should get hold of and read and absorb to help inform their decision?
Absolutely. And both of them are mentioned in different forms in my book. The first one is A Sense of Honor by James Webb. I mentioned several of Senator Webb's books in my own. I was influenced as a young person by reading his book, A Sense of Honor, which takes place he was a class of 68, so it takes place during that time period. I think it's a fantastic book, and I really enjoyed it. And it's one that every now and again I enjoy pulling off the shelf and reading. Another one is by David Poyer, who is the class of 1971, and it's called The Return of Philo T. McGiffen. Similar time frame. Captain Poyer was class of 71, so again, it kind of takes place around that same time period, a little bit later than A Sense of Honor, but both are really great books. I was honored that David Poyer read this manuscript, and he gave me a nice quote for the jacket, and I was very appreciative. To me, that was a nice victory to have accolades from him. Those are the only two that I can think of off the top of my head, because those, I think, are the two classic novels that folks want to look at about the Naval Academy. I hope, naturally, that someday my novel, The Recipient's Son, is mentioned in the same breath with those two.
Well, if I have the chance to discuss people who want to go to the Naval Academy books, your book will certainly be on the list that I give them. As we wind down our time with you, Steve, what have you got in your hopper next, and what can we look forward to?
Sure. I mentioned last time when I did Proximity, I have two other books in the work that are in the EOD realm. One, I think, is going to become sort of a lifelong project. It's a grind to do it, and it's very important to do it right, and that is Improvised, EOD Techs in the War on Terrorism. And through that book, what I've been doing is interviewing EOD techs about their experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think some of it's going to expand now into other aspects of the war on terrorism. And I intend for it to come out as a nonfiction account of what those guys are doing. Each story that I hear is more amazing than the next. Just the heroism of the young EOD technicians of all services, unbelievable. But hold on to that one. I think the one that will actually emerge first will be my sequel to Proximity. It has a working title of Pressure Release. We're going to see Jazz Jasinski again. We're going to see the FBI agent Elena Cruz again. Some of the other favorite characters will return. Grover Deng's going to come back, and the mysterious Tracy's going to return. That one is fairly mature, and I hope that we see that one within the next few years.
Well, that's great. We look forward to seeing those things. And let me again tell the people who are listening in that this is a really good book, and you ought to take a chance of, when you get the chance, go pick it up.
Thank you.
Absolutely agree. And, Steve, I really appreciate you coming on this afternoon. It's been a really quick 30 minutes, and I look forward to reading what you have coming down the road.
Great. Can I add one or two more things?
Absolutely.
I hope folks will follow me. It's the social media age, right? I'm on Twitter. I'm at EOD author on Twitter. You can follow me on Facebook. It's www.facebook.com/author Stephen Phillips. And if you go on Facebook and look at the title of both of my books, The Recipient Son and Proximity, there's a page for each one of those if you like those in particular.
Perfect. And I look forward to seeing the rest of the rollout with the book because you're still early on. You should have a real busy fall. And best of luck to you, Steve.
Thank you very much, and thank you again for having me on MidRats.
Okay, thanks for coming on. We enjoyed it.
And just a quick reminder to everybody, that was our first guest for today, author Steve Phillips, for his book, The Recipient Son. You can find links to him over at the Blog Talk Radio show page. Now we're going to shift over to another side of the Navy. Like I said over in the intro, our guest for the second half of the show is going to be Lieutenant Commander Chris Cervello, U.S. Navy. He is over at the Navy News Desk, the OI TAC-31 for you technical thinking folks. He is the Public Affairs Assistant to the Vice Chief of Naval Operations. Chris, welcome to MidRats.
Thank you very much for having me on, Sal and Eagle One. I look forward to chatting with you guys this afternoon.
Really appreciate it. I think it's a great opportunity. A lot of our listeners are obviously big consumers of media. And whenever something is coming up in the Navy, whether it's technical, whether it's operational, one of the first when things are done right, which I think you'll appreciate, one of the first things that's going to hit the media are statements that come from this PAO, public affairs officer working for person X, Y, and Z. Most people out there, you know, they can identify what a naval officer, what a naval aviator does. They can identify what a surface warfare officer does. Sometimes they can describe what submariners or EODs, like our previous guest. But what is the core function of a Navy public affairs officer?
Well, I think the core function of what our Navy PAO does is we have to be the lead communicator, the expert communicator on a commander's staff. And so I want to be very clear, that doesn't mean that we do all the communicating. It doesn't mean that we own the message, so to speak. I mean, because obviously that the message belongs to the commander, but we need to be the expert that the commander can look at. Whether it's in times of good news, bad news, or any other time in between, to provide the commander and the staff with the right expertise and the right advice on what's happening in the communication environment, when the right time to talk is, and when the right time to listen is, and to be able to give them that feedback throughout as they look to communicate and tell their story or be part of the Navy story, so to speak.
How do you work with getting his narrative or the narrative of the command out to make sure that your concept of the message and his concept of the message are the same?
Well, I mean, I don't know that. I think it's important that it's his message, it's his narrative, and I think that you alluded to it or Sal alluded to it when you introduced me. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of opportunities. There's a lot of places to get that narrative out. And so, what the public affairs officer does, I think, is we've got to be the expert on building those relationships across those channels. So if it's with the traditional media, if it's with bloggers like you and Sal, if it's with influencers, we need to know what's happening in that world so that we know how that what the commander wants to put out will be received. We need to provide the commander feedback from those folks and help structure it in a way that reaches the most people and ensures that we get that message out in a way that is best for the commander and best for the Navy.
And Chris, because you wear the uniform, because you're a naval officer, there's a lot more there when people look at, what's the civilian equivalent of a public affairs officer, they think of, oh, like the press secretary, Carney. He's kind of like that. There are some aspects that are similar to that, but your charter's a lot different in many important ways to that. What are some misconceptions people have about what a public affairs officer there is doing, either a bad preconception, or what are the things in a positive way people think that you should do that actually is not inside your charter as a public affairs officer?
Well, I think first and foremost it's important to remember that I am an ABLE officer, and that's where my loyalties lie. They lie to the Navy, you know, they lie with the Navy, not as a public affairs officer. So I have to remember that first. Our charter is not to spin. It's important that I'm seen as somebody that works with and espouses the truth. And so I think that those are probably the two biggest. I mean, my role is not to be loyal to my boss first. It's to be loyal to the Navy and make sure that we do right by our sailors, that we do right by the American people, and that we're always telling the truth. I mean, there are certainly tactics that as you get more experienced and you understand the environment more that you can. You can share with your boss to make getting that message out more effective, but you can never forget who your loyalties lie with.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the dichotomy, because you've got, in your case, you're working for the vice commandant of the Navy or whatever, I can't remember, the vice CNO, I guess, but there are also PAO who are concerned with the Navy. The large picture of the Navy. Is there a split there that you can just make clear for me?
Well, I think like many people in the Navy, we wear a couple different hats. I mean, my primary role is as the head of our Navy news desk. I'm responsible for making sure that we get the Navy story out and that we engage with media. We engage with mill bloggers like yourself to be able to. Both push the Navy story as well as answer questions about it. And then my job for the vice chief is that, I make sure that I advise him on his personal public affairs issues when he goes out and does events or when he has things that he wants to put out or that we need to respond to within his personal portfolio. I make sure that I provide him the right communication advice. So, I think the two are very complementary, and one has certainly helped me with the other as I've been in this job over the last 3 years.
Steve, over in the chat room, BJ Armstrong brought up an interesting point. I wonder if you could take it out and run with it a little bit. But Admiral Stavridis, he talks about getting rid of the idea of people need to know, but to go towards more of an idea of a need to share. Even though you work for the vice CNO and other PAOs work directly for commanders, should public affairs just be about that commander's message, or should there be a greater outreach about the sailors and the JO stories as well?
I think that if it's just about the commander's message, I don't think that we're really telling the whole story for the Navy. I mean, certainly there are things that. That flag officers and senior leaders in the Navy, there are aspects of the story that they lend to it. But I mean, with the growth of the online medium, with more and more junior officers sharing firsthand stories, and no blogging for themselves, I think they've created a robustness that has long been absent from the Navy story. Partly they round out that story and provide a sense of reality and a sense of truth that maybe folks didn't think existed prior. I think that they hold in a very public fashion, they hold their leadership to standards of reality and they force them to communicate in a more two-way fashion rather than just put out a message and move on to the next. So I mean I think that they've made they've increased the engagement, and they've certainly lended a robustness that maybe 10 years ago didn't exist.
when you get in a situation where you are getting feedback through the various social media that maybe the junior officer or the junior enlisted or even the senior officer or senior enlisted in the fleet are not all that impressed with the messages being sent, how do you get that feedback back to your boss?
For me personally, you know, it's a regular drumbeat in terms of meeting with senior leadership. A number of senior leaders that I have worked with in the past or work with now, I mean, they consume that media directly. So it's not like they need me to go to them and say, hey, I read on Sailor Bob or I read on the USNI, blog or Salamander said this. In many cases, they are consuming that information themselves, and it becomes part of our discussion in terms of what the next move is from a communication standpoint or from a larger event. So I think that really shows the growth and the power of mill blogging and some of this two-way engagement that, again, we previously didn't see, is that not only is the PAO consuming it and feeding it back to the commander, the commander's is consuming it themselves directly, and in the case of folks like Admiral Stavridis and others, they're on there engaging with folks directly, and you see not only are they communicating in that medium, but you see the effects of that medium on their larger communication strategy.
And just one thing I meant to mention earlier, but I didn't. I ran into Chris over on Twitter. He's at @bull_PAO. At least you didn't flip the two of those together, but we have bull_PAO over there at Twitter. And that's how I found Chris, and Chris and I carried on a conversation. And you mentioned somebody that brings up one of my questions here, is you get new media, and there are a lot of PAOs out there who do get new media, and it's an important way of keeping a pulse of what's going on in the background conversation. And Admiral Stavridis and Admiral Harvey, and Admiral Harvey left us recently, and of course Admiral Stavridis, he's not long for this active duty world either, I think. And I met them first online. I've met them subsequently in person, have had good conversations with them. They get new media. They've got it from the beginning. But when I look past Admiral Harvey and Admiral Stavridis, and I don't want to put you in the spot here, because just because somebody doesn't get it or interchange it doesn't make them bad. It's just not their area of expertise. Some people are good at things more than others. But obviously, Chimfo is, luckily he gets new media as well, but I'm really looking towards the senior naval leadership, somebody that can occupy that new media space as well as Harvey and Stavridis. And Chris, who am I missing out there in our 3- and 4-star leadership that could fill that new media space, and that people who previously were reading or looking for Admiral Harvey and Admiral Stavridis when they leave active duty, who can those people seek out and look and connect with and monitor what they're posting online that get the new media like those two admirals did?
Well, I think certainly you can look, really at the top of our organization. I think the CNO, if you look at, the vlogs that he puts out on a regular basis, if you look at his Facebook page, he certainly engages in a different way than Admiral Stavridis and Harvey. But, for him, using new media is a way, and I don't want to speak for him, but I believe it's his way of reaching out to sailors and families. The CNO, it's very much his voice. It sounds like him. It reads like him. It's his, his brevity, but yet his breadth of issues that he wants to make sure he conveys. So I think, he gets it. He certainly has encouraged others to embrace it. I mean, I think, I named a few in the blog and in the Facebook, but we just did an online town hall meeting in which we crowdsourced for questions via email and over our live stream chat and Twitter. He and the MCPON answered questions from that online, from those online solicitations. So I think, you know, Admiral Greenard is a good example. There are others, but I mean, I take your point. I mean, I think that it is certainly something that as I move in both the public affairs circles and in the circles of the Pentagon, I will say that I am more and more encouraged that senior leaders get it. And I think they're dipping their toes in the water. And I think that it's something that you will start to see more leaders do in the future. I'm encouraged, though, that we aren't seeing folks do it just to do it. I think that was a concern when it became very, very much in vogue in the Navy to have some of these sites, that you would see senior leaders, just do new media to do new media, and I'm not seeing that. So in addition to leaders like the CNO embracing it, I think it's a positive sign that we don't have folks just doing it for the sake of doing it.
What is a good day for a PAO, and what worst day you can have as a PAO?
I don't know that there. I mean, I don't really, discriminate between the two. I mean, I personally would much rather be telling, news about the fleet and what our sailors are doing and sharing that with news media. Any time you have to, so I would say I guess that's good news, or a good day. Any time you have to talk about the loss of a sailor, anytime you have to share the story of someone who died in Afghanistan or prior to that in Iraq, I mean, and work with the families on what the families want to say about our sailors or put out information to the local media about the sailors. I mean, that obviously is probably as low as this job gets. I mean, but I very much enjoy telling, being a part of the Navy story. I enjoy telling the Navy story. I mean, I grew up, I'm the son of a retired chief petty officer. So, I've been in the Navy, I'd say, my whole life. So for me, getting to do this for a living and share the stories of the great things our sailors are doing, and at times the not so great things, but providing the needed context that goes along with that, I think is an important job. And, I think it lends value in today's communication environment.
Over in the chat room, Herb reminded us of something that was true. I thought the F-18 crash that we had earlier this year, I thought the PAOs did a really good job. I mean, that's really almost a classroom test case of how to do it right. I thought the PAOs did a real good job of keeping people properly informed as things progressed, and I think that was a great confidence builder. And the first PAO I really got to know was good old Commander Charlie Brown, great guy. He and I started communicating with each other real early on in my online presence. And, of course, I enjoy the back and forth with you. On a couple of occasions, you reached out and thumped me on the forehead, and I think you had a right to thump me on the forehead. But there are also a few other PAOs that I keep in touch with when I hear something in the background that I'll touch base with them, just say, hey, this is kind of bouncing around here. Do you have a comment going on here? So I always encourage other people to use PAOs because it's a nice, the more I've worked with them, the better they get. It's really a positive thing. There are a couple of less than stellar occasions out there, but those are so far the exception, not the rule. But one of the challenges I wanted to ask you about when you're dealing with other people in the media is when you really have a good story that you want to get out, because it not only is a good story, it also folds in well to a larger mission that's going on. I'm asking this question as a personal background, something that I was involved with when I was deployed and worked at the PAO. It never made it out of DVIDS clips. I sent a link to my mom, and she appreciated it and all. But it really was a really good story, but it just never, ever got any traction. When you're out there trying to push a story, how far can a PAO go to try to push a story before they have to back off? And what type of process do you use to try to get those stories that nobody seems to be covering but you feel really needs to get out there for people to know about?
Well, you kind of alluded to it both in your discussion about the F-18 crash and you know, in talking about Charlie Brown. I think, as well as for selling a story or you know, pitching a story, I think it comes down to relationships in many cases. So let me just sort of run that a little bit through the examples that you gave, and then I'll finish up by answering your question. You know, appreciate the kudos on about the F-18 crash. I mean, obviously the best part of that story was that no one was seriously injured or killed in what could have been a very bad situation. But really the key to that communication effort was, I mean, yes, there were some PAOs that were on top of it, but really the key to that were the relationships that that the commanders of Fleet Forces Command and Oceana over time had built up with the city of Virginia Beach. And so those built, and with the news media, and so built on those relationships, we were able to comfortably get information out quickly. You know, we didn't have to worry about stepping on the mayor's toes or vice versa. We were able to put out the most relevant and accurate information that we had, you know, darn near real time using new media. So that was leveraging those relationships. You know, that conversation or those conversations that you have with Charlie Brown or you have with me, I mean, it's about building a relationship. It's about so that I can share information with you sometimes in the public realm over Twitter or through or on your blog or vice versa, or sometimes it's a phone call or an email shot back and forth, just to make sure that you know, I understand what you're working and you understand what I'm working, and when we may be wrong. You know, so that those relationships are very important. So to answer your question, I think it's the relationships that we have, you know, with the news media, so that they know when we come to them that we understand what their constraints are, we understand what their interests are, and based on those relationships, I think we're able to push them stories or give them the information from those stories that help them put together something. And share them with the American people on a larger scale. Now, not every story is going to make it to you know, the national media. Not every story is going to make it on the CNNs and the New York Times of the world. But that's where I think you know, quality public affairs officers, quality Navy communicators, can look across the spectrum. So, okay, if it's not going to make it in traditional media, okay, how can I pitch it to mill bloggers? How can I pitch it to you know, using our own platforms on the Navy side to ensure that it gets out? I mean, in some cases, in today's world, you know, the traditional media has a less of an audience or is not the right audience to pitch some of these stories. So in some cases, it makes sense to pitch it to mill bloggers or new media first. To get it out, and you'd be surprised that once it's out in those mediums, you know, traditional media sort of latch on and tell it. So it's really understanding the relationships, understanding how best to pitch the story, and you know, really working your butt off to be able to tell the Navy story.
I suppose I'm a commanding officer of a ship or some other kind of unit, and something has popped up where there may be some news media interest. When should I get a hold of my friendly neighborhood PAO, and what kind of stuff should I tell him in anticipation of press interest?
Well, you know, hopefully the public affairs officer is talking to you long before, you know, you have good news or bad news that needs to make it out. I don't know if you remember that old cartoon. It was, I think it's a Broadside cartoon where there's the public affairs officer is encased in glass, and I think the caption says, you know, break in emergency or something like that. In today's world, that's way too late. And I realize that not every unit has a public affairs officer there, you know, either in the wardroom or where they can reach out and touch, but hopefully there's some mechanism in which the public affairs officer is talking to that commanding officer regularly, that they're sharing information. The PAO or a number of PAOs are helping that commanding officer, cultivate and maintain his or her, communication strategy, and so that it's just a natural part of the discussion when you reach an inflection point and it's time to share that with the larger audience. But, you know, so we've tried very hard over the last couple of years to be more visible on the waterfront, to be more visible on the key staff, and to make sure that we're part of an everyday conversation versus, you know, as that cartoon says, in an emergency, you know, you have to reach out and grab us.
Yeah, because you get it, I know you're familiar with this illusion. Unfortunately, on action figure therapy, there isn't a public affairs officer up there, which would be interesting if there was. But what, a little bit beyond the what do you do here question, public affairs officer, how does one, you know, decide they are not decide, how does one become a public affairs officer, and what does that career path look like if there was you know, a young man or woman out there who'd be interested, hey, I want to, this sounds interesting, I want to serve the country, I'm not too big on the whole boats, planes, and submarines things, but this public affairs thing sounds like something interesting I'd want to do. What would their career path look like, and how would they get there?
Sure. The three most common ways of becoming a public affairs officer is many of us are lateral transfers from the fleet. That means we started out in the fleet doing something else. You know, we heard the calling, so to speak, we applied to the twice annual lateral transfer board. You know, we had some previous experience, either whether it's an academic with communications or you know, some on the job training, and we were competitive and got picked up. The other is you know, through the Seaman and Admiral program. So we had some enlisted training in communications, or we had some education at the enlisted level, and through the Seaman and Admiral program. We were picked up that way. Or if for many of our reserves, you know, we were a direct commission. And for most of these folks, they have a civilian background in communication. Either they, you know, communication degree, they work for in the communication industry or public relations, and so we bring them into the reserve community that way. You know, really with all three, having some sort of either fleet communication experience or academic experience is important. And then beyond that, you know, our career path, we spend the first couple tours learning from senior public affairs officers. So for me, I started out at CHINFO, learning from a commander and the admiral at the time. I did that for a tour. I went out to Sixth Fleet and got some fleet public affairs experience, as well as worked with some other senior folks. And then there's an opportunity to have your own shop, whether that means that you're a public affairs officer on an aircraft carrier and you work directly for a flag officer, or you work at a TICOM, and then on to the fleet level, and then on to some of our larger Navy staffs or COCOMs at that point. So you really work your way up through, you know, from the tactical part of the Navy, up through the operational staff, and then to some of our larger fleet and COCOM staff.
Well, how did you personally get involved in this? I mean, did you start out in the fleet and then move over? How did you get in this?
I did. I started out as an aviator. I had some medical trouble and was sent to an aircraft carrier where I had a great opportunity to work on the flight deck as a catapult officer during the beginning of OIF. We had a lot of media on board. You know, it was something that I knew I had to find a follow-on job after being a shooter. Was always interested in communicating, I became a public affairs officer that way. I credit more than anything those 3 years on an aircraft carrier and my you know time as in the fleet to helping me become a public affairs officer, but two, I never forget, you know, whose story I'm telling. And I never forget that at the root of all that I do, the importance of, you know, the operations behind that, you know, as long as I work behind a desk in D.C., you know, I never forget what it's like to, you know, smell the salt water or the JP-5 or what have you.
Well, Chris, thank you a lot for coming on this afternoon. Really appreciate it. Just want to make sure everybody that's up on Twitter, if you want to keep track of what Chris is keeping track for you, It's at @bull_PAO over at Twitter. Hey, Chris, just as we head out the door, I wanted to ask you one question. Obviously, besides Eagle Speak and Commander Salamander, if the listeners here wanted to start their morning reading what a PAO reads to get a pulse of what's going, what are those first three or four places that you go or dead tree that you read in the morning that, as a PAO that you feel is going to get you ready for the rest of the day?
Sure. I live and breathe on Twitter, so I bring in a number of the traditional media, other mill bloggers. I'm a huge Gowron fan and the folks that write on his site. In addition to the two of you, as well as read the US and I blog every day. My first job in the morning is to put together the Chinfo clip, so I get a real good taste of what's out there. In terms of the early bird and the Chinfo clips, but probably the biggest plug is for folks to get on Twitter, find who they're interested in terms of whether it's mill bloggers or traditional media, and stay on that. I think that's a great tool to stay informed and as well as to share your thoughts on what people are talking about.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate it, and hope you have a great week. We didn't get you any trouble, Chris.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Chris. Have a good time.
You got it. We also appreciate everybody. We had a real good chat room today. Got a couple good questions out of there. So thank you very much, everybody in the chat room. And for those that are joining us pre-recorded, Claude, yes, I'm talking to you. Next time, join us live for another edition of MidRats. And until then, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
For you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me.